welcome, listeners, to this episode of the WIP 12 podcast. I'm your host, Kyle, and I've been joined today by Michael, a.k.a. Barakiel. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kyle. Good to be back.
Yeah. We have what I think is a very exciting episode today. We're going to be talking about hacking, and we'll start with a little bit of a rundown just to establish some vocabulary and basic concepts. If you are new, if you need something to occupy the space while you are driving to work, feel free to listen through that if you want to skip it. I would guess about 20 minutes. I would like to say that I would go in and add a timestamp, but I'm probably not going to do that, so I apologize in advance.
A fair disclaimer.
Yeah. So just in case, Michael, will you remind us who you are and what you're doing?
Sure. My name is Michael DeLarbe. I'm a California-based Infinity player. I've been playing Infinity since 2011. I've been an active ITS competitor, a war core. I'm active in the community. Helped to get the Bay Area meta started here in the San Francisco Bay Area of California, and have been on a few different podcasts now. And most notably, it's really nice to be here with you, Kyle, having a chance to chat about hacking.
Heck yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for joining me again. What armies are you currently playing? I know most listeners may recognize you as a Pano player, but you did do our Bakunin episode. How's that going with the update?
Yeah. So I've, jump shipped, not very thoroughly, but certainly Nomads have occupied a lot of my attention lately. Anybody who says there's sort of no grass is greener dynamic, I definitely feel like the toolbox is deeper, more profound, more powerful with Nomads. That's a conversation for a different day. But yes, I've been enjoying Bakunin, keeping an eye on how the Nomad toolbox continues to expand. But, looking into a new ITS season here, obviously we've got some pretty interesting developments coming out, especially some ways to sort of flex and play around with the 15 order cap, which is something that I've always had particularly strong feelings about in the current rule edition. So excited to see how that unfolds. Once again, probably a topic for a different day, but we live in interesting times as far as Infinity is concerned.
Definitely. Cool. I mean, I'm just excited to see a Swiss Guard show up in every Pano army.
Right. Who would find that objectionable other than the person across the table from the Pano player?
Yeah. Although really having a forward deployed Swiss Guard hacker, I think we'll likely see that profile a little more than we have.
I have used the Swiss Guard hacker in ITS events, and not just ITS events, but notable ITS events. It's a valid profile and, a good specialist with durability and a multi-rifle is not a bad tool at all. So I like the idea when the meta can be sort of reinvented and put some emphasis on profiles or play styles that maybe were not as pronounced or not as popular before. So it's doing what it should be doing, which is creating a little bit of a shakeup.
Cool. I love it. All right. Let's get into our main event. So InfoWar, hacking. It is a part of the game that we all know and love, or know and loathe, depending on how many times you've been missiled by Nomads or other armies. The first thing I want to do is just talk through very briefly the different hacking programs, what they do, and if there's anything special to note about them. So I've just broken this down in the way they're presented somewhere, maybe in the app. Starting with the Evo hacker and the Evo programs. So our Evo hacking devices are usually going to be on those baggage bots that most armies have. And then there's a couple other hackers that will show up with Evo hackers. Syla and the War Driver come to mind. And then I think Toha, at least for the moment, has access to an Evo hacker. What's the Ariadna bot?
Mule.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tractor mule? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got assisted fire, which gives anything. So it can be used on a remote, and then that remote gets effectively marksmanship. So it can ignore cover on the attack. Enhanced reaction gives a +1 burst in defense, which recently had an update that allowed you to stack that with fire team bonuses so that you can get that burst 3 in reactive for a linked remote. Fairy dust, you can pick one type of unit, so a remote, heavy infantry, or tag, and then those units will all get effectively a bonus against hackers trying to hack them. And then finally, controlled jump to either boost your own combat jumpers or interfere with your opponent's combat jumpers. Anything else there?
I mean, I've always appreciated Evo. If you're a new player or you're trying to sort of mentally categorize all of this in your mind, I always appreciate the fact that Evo is really basically centered around buffing other units. Yeah. I mean, Evo basically has virtually zero capability in and of itself, but is very much, you know, a buffer of units, an augmenter of stats, allows for, you know, impressive capabilities. But obviously, too, it takes resources and also has the potential to sort of telegraph your strategy or indicate what it is you sort of plan to do through presence of an Evo being there on the table. But I've always liked the place that Evo is. I feel like every iteration of the game, Evo tends to have a valuable role. And I like the fact, too, that there is a way to actually directly augment or buff the stats of your units, which isn't really common in Infinity compared to a lot of other game systems.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's also worth noting that even if you have, any Evo hacker can only have one Evo program active at a time. So if you've got marksmanship on a unit and your opponent is going to do a combat jump and you're going to reactively put up controlled jump, then that is going to end the marksmanship on that remote.
Which is probably a good thing, I guess, given the overall low point cost of Evo in general. Yeah. But at the same time, too, I mean, maybe a conversation for a different day, but at the same time, too, any application where you can actually apply this stuff, especially since a lot of these you're sort of proactively spending an order, you know, which is a currency in and of itself in order to be able to apply the buff. I wouldn't mind being able to maintain multiple at once. It definitely would make the Evo sort of a juicier target for your opponent to hunt down, especially after you dumped a bunch of orders into it. But I can understand the desire for limitation there.
Yeah. I would also love to see the return of the ability to start with an active Evo program. That was a nice little thing we had for a hot second there in one or two ITS seasons. But being able to start with that assisted fire up, or that enhanced reaction up to add a little bit more to the defender, I don't think is a bad thing.
Yeah, I always appreciate when the ITS season plays around with first turn versus second turn. Sometimes I feel like it's overtuned, sometimes I feel as though it's undertuned, but allowing a player to pay the points for Evo on their list and then invest the on-table resources to start with one of those programs, you know, I've always felt that was thematic, was appropriate. I liked it as a concept. And, you know, obviously enhanced reaction, you touched upon it, but what a massive change. I mean, enhanced reaction has always sort of occupied this funny niche where maybe you put it on a remote that has a template, and that was sort of the best use you got out of it, was taking a heavy shotgun remote from burst 1 to burst 2, so it could stand at a corner and be dangerous, but it was sort of hard to leverage that flat burst 2 reliably in a gunfighting context. But now it's, you know, the leash has been taken off and it's very, very powerful. So definitely worth being aware of, worth noting, especially if you see an Evo across from you and you know that your opponent has the ability to link remotes.
Definitely. All right. Anything else for Evos, or should we move on to the Killer Hackers?
I think that covers it.
Cool. All right. So Killer Hackers, often going to be skirmishers, very frequently come with some sort of marker state or hidden deployment. Usually they're only going to get two programs. Trinity is the offensive, do damage to enemy hackers, but not other hackable units, just hackers. And then Cyber Mask is a impersonation light. You can impersonate so you can get past mines or get around things that would normally be able to react to camouflage. Although I find that I don't use it that often, but it has come up before.
Yeah, I think you've covered it. In my mind, the value of a killer hacker is the fact that you're typically deploying a fairly inexpensive upfield specialist who's providing, classified objective coverage or getting situational bonuses for the scenario in question as a hacker. Obviously, there's the downside of hacking vulnerability. You put a big target on your head because suddenly you're susceptible to your opponent's hackers. But I feel like the give and trade there is fair and is valid. Yeah. And I find that players tend to undervalue Trinity, but at the end of the day, it's still a pretty high probability exchange. If you're doing burst three on burst one, that's pretty much always going to yield a favorable outcome. And then tactically, you have to actually maneuver and manipulate so that you're not facing stacked AROs. You're actually isolating that target. But, I've had plenty of situations where Trinity against a misdeployed or overextended hacker ends up playing a significant role. And then Cyber Mask is niche, but those situations where you're able to apply it can be strong, can be really strong. So I feel like in this situation, you get what you pay for. You pay a little bit for a killer hacker. You get a little bit of utility, a little bit of offensive power. And generally speaking, I like that niche.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. And then we have the regular hacking device. And then all of these programs are included in the Hacking Device Plus. Once again, a specialist. Carbonite gives you a double action, burst two or burst one in ARO, attempt to freeze an opponent in place and mobilize them. Spotlight, obviously, we've come to know and have feelings about Spotlight and the ability to use it in the reactive turn. Total Control is to possess a tag and take control of it. Worth noting that the controlled profile of a tag has a different stat line than the base tag, so your BS is going to drop pretty significantly, but you're still getting control of an enemy tag. And then Oblivion is that AP damage 16 to isolate a hackable model. Yeah.
I mean, I feel as though this category, standard hacking devices, regular hacking devices, is basically where 90% of the identity of hacking belongs. I mean, basically in those, you mentioned four programs, but it's really, probably three programs here that have basically defined the entire meta as it relates to hacking. Spotlight, Total Control, Oblivion have basically created the entire identity and the entire arms race of hacking as we know it this edition. And their ability to have an impact, their ability to project power, their ability to either frustrate your opponent, enable your battle plan, in some cases, shut down models or remove opposing models completely from the table, hinge on those programs. And there's a lot to unpack. Maybe we want to save it for later in the episode, but this is, in my mind, sort of the defining meta consideration of this edition. And it's right there in those three programs, Spotlight, Total Control, Oblivion.
Definitely. Yeah. We'll come back to those and talk about them and when to use them and what we like and hate about them. So the Hacking Device Plus brings those four programs along with White Noise, which is creates an anti-MSV zone. So any MSV, it treats it as effectively smoke. So you're looking at a no visibility zone. And it comes with all of the same bells and whistles. So being shot through it and you take a penalty unless you have Sixth Sense and yada yada. And then Cyber Mask, exactly the same as the Killer Hacker has. So Hacking Device Plus is just bringing a little bit of extra utility that some factions are very sad to not have any access to.
Yeah, and both of these I think are right where they should be. We're all familiar with the prevalence and sort of the universal phenomena of multispectral visor defensive units, Overwatch units, and the ability to use White Noise to mess with them, to interdict, especially if you're in sort of the funny niche where you have access to White Noise but don't have access to something like Eclipse Grenades. So there's great play there. There's fun dynamics for interaction with white noise. Cyber Mask on a Plus device almost universally seems to be, I'm going to hide my hacking lieutenant so you can't, you know, grenade him or rush him with a chain rifle. And that generally is how I see it utilized. Sometimes I also see it utilized for the value of, you know, playing around with modifiers when you're hacking offensively. Certainly there's something to be said for that too, if you actually want to use your hacking device plus in that fashion. But, you know, also a good program, and I feel like more so than the killer hacker, where often you have the camo state that you can easily utilize as well. Hacking device plus really benefits from Cyber Mask as a way of interdicting incoming damage and helping to shut off or screen off a lot of those avenues of attack that hackers are frequently susceptible to.
Right. Especially because a model with a hacking device plus is often going to be fairly expensive or at the very least important to your list. You mentioned that often that's a lieutenant, or it may be, you know, a 50 to 70 point model that you don't want to get targeted and then missiled, for example.
Yeah, certainly nobody wants to be in that situation at all. And I like the fact, too, that the Cyber Mask is fairly easy to implement, fairly easy to utilize. It's become very fluid in this game system compared to previous editions. And so appropriately balanced, and I like that it's there for Hacking Device Plus. It feels like an appropriate upgrade and something that's sort of special and rare relative to standard or regular hacking devices.
Yeah. Cool. So that's all of our programs. There are some special considerations with some hacking devices, but, you know, those will come up. The other mechanic that I think it's important to just talk through very briefly is repeaters as a mechanism to extend hacking range, because obviously when you're hacking, it's within that zone of control, and then the repeaters add, you know, the additional zone of control of the repeater to your ability to hack, and it creates those lopsided dynamics where if you have a screen of repeaters, then your opponent will have a harder time getting that killer hacker to target just the lieutenant, right? You'll have the option to be able to pile on AROs, and then of course, conversely, you can use repeaters to get that killer hacker to kind of scalpel out a specific target, for example.
Yeah, repeaters are, I mean, in my mind, repeaters are both an absolutely necessary mechanic, simply because hacking being so limited in range, you know, how else are you going to be able to apply it without putting models at risk, dumping a ton of orders? But the flip side, too, is I feel like the ability to deploy upfield repeaters with tremendous order efficiency is one of the sort of more problematic aspects of hacking from a balance standpoint. And I think that all depends, you know, that's going to start getting us into the meta of hacking, the haves and the have nots in terms of, you know, powerful tools, powerful hackers, et cetera. Right. But there's no question that if you're making use of hacking, the hackers themselves are almost incidental. Their stats, their abilities, their capabilities are a lot less important in my mind than how quickly and efficiently, using as few orders as possible, can they make their impact known on the battlefield. And repeaters are 100% the cornerstone of that. You're very rarely putting your hackers directly in harm's way. You're almost always using repeaters to be able to project their area of influence. And so repeaters are massive.
Yeah, definitely. And the way, I guess, you know, when you are hacking an enemy model through their repeater, so if you're using an enemy repeater, that model is going to get the firewall bonuses, which are effectively cover. So you're taking a -3 to your whip roll, and they're getting a +3 on their BTS roll. Tin bots can add to that. And then The way we get repeaters on the table, it's going to be through pitchers, deployable repeaters, or onboard repeaters. So a lot of remotes, the Tachimoto or forward observer bots, the 7-point flash pulse repeater bots, and then even a handful of combat remotes are going to bring repeaters to push the efficacy of hackers. And I know that we'll talk about pitchers quite a bit because they are a pretty significant tool for expanding that range of hacking without actually bringing any risk to your models.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Okay. So I've got a list of topics to kind of talk through and our experiences with them. Obviously, this is not going to be the be-all, end-all of how to use hacking. Someone will have some approach they'll have that is not ours, and we're going to bring our armies and our experiences to the table, things that we've seen that have worked well, things that we've seen that haven't, things that we've tried. So, yeah. Anything else you want to go over for the basics, or should we dive in?
Well, I think that is a good outline of what's to come. I know for me, speaking from my perspective, you know, I've played through multiple editions. Hacking has changed tremendously in that time. And so for me, when I talk about hacking, the perspective or the background I'm coming from was when hacking was previously very weak, previously very different. And then also playing armies where I was virtually always on the receiving end of hacking. You know, occasionally I'd do some offensive hacking. But really, that was like applying killer hacking devices in the Red Rum days and things of that nature. Yeah. But more recently, you know, in the past few years, hacking has become a more dynamic, more involved component of my play. Being able to make use of it, building lists around it, centering strategies on it, and having it be more than, okay, classified objective coverage or a killer hacking device so I can nuke the other guy, has been rewarding. It's been emotional, but I'm excited to get into it.
Definitely. Okay, so I don't know. I guess we can go through these in order, unless you see something that you want to bring up first.
That works for me.
Cool. All right. So building your repeater network. You know, obviously this is very dependent on the army. If you're playing Pano or one of the NA2s that have access to them, you might start with the repeater forward in the form of a peacemaker. If you've got access to Guilang or the new observance, it's not a skirmisher, I'm forgetting her name, she's got a deployable repeater, you may start with skirmishers forward that have repeaters either in their back pocket or actually on the table with mine layer. So how do you approach? You're just, you know, you're getting to a table, you're setting up, whether you're going first or second. What are you thinking about in building your repeater network?
Good thought. I mean, the big thing is that it's going to be a double-edged sword. And that was the most common mistake that I made early on when I was seeking to sort of push the hacking playstyle and familiarize myself with it, was I would very quickly deploy the repeater network in order to get good coverage, give myself spotlight AROs, be able to, you know, oblivion stuff as it maneuvers around objectives. And these are all sort of, you know, hacking 101 this edition. But the biggest thing is timing. You know, do you do it right away in order to contest your opponent's early moves? Do you wait until there's some attrition and some piece removal so that your opponent has fewer hackers to respond with? Or do you, you know, try to surprise your opponent, get it out there at a certain time as he's on the verge of making a critical move, objective rush or something like that, so that suddenly he has to deal with the mental strain of building a new plan on the fly when you've really only spent one or two orders just putting a repeater in a key area. And all of that is valid. One of the beauties of Infinity and beauties of the game in general, and this is certainly true for hacking, is that there's not necessarily a right or wrong answer in any of those situations. It's all going to be dependent on your opponent, the mission, the matchup, how you build your list. But that's where judgment comes in, and that's where player experience comes in. And so for me, trying to follow the standard format of I'm always going to put my repeater network out there turn one. I'm going to lob pitchers. I'm going to reload them. I'm going to lob them again. I'm going to run remotes out there so that they're standing in key areas. The result was I was giving my opponent easy access to my network, and they were able to turn my repeaters against me. And I had games where somebody would literally walk a killer hacking device into range of one of my repeaters, split burst with Trinity across multiple hackers, and score kills. Were the odds in their favor? No. Is that a tactically sound practice? No. But it happened. And so in this case, their decision was validated. My decision was wrong because the dice played out in their favor.
Right.
And so that was eye-opening for me that, building a repeater network is 100% the most important aspect of projecting your hacking power. But you still have to apply tactical judgment just as you would with a model standing up for ARO or staying prone, keeping his head down. You still have to apply the same judgment.
Right. And I mean, it's going to depend on matchup and table a lot, right? If you know that your opponent is, say, putting down O12 or Starmada, there is very likely going to be a Raptor in there, which is a powerhouse of a killer hacker. And if you are putting forward your repeaters, that thing is likely going to be able to score some kills, right? Your opponent may put firewalls up on it. And then because, you know, if they've got a tag, they may want to have that Evo hacker to back it up. And then you're looking at this killer hacker rolling through with a reasonable BTS, and it can chew through your repeaters and be okay on the other side. On the other hand, you've got Ariadna or Deshot. Like, put those repeaters up, get those spotlights off. But then it's also maybe not going to be as effective because they may be leaning on skirmishers a lot more and things that are not actually going to be hackable except for spotlights.
Yeah, and that's definitely a consideration too, is, you know, what programs are you seeking to leverage? How vulnerable is your opponent actually to your hacking game? And how have you built your list to actually be able to leverage hacking? You know, if you just slap spotlight on something, you know, maybe that's good. Obviously, it's nice to gain an advantage and augment your own troops in that way when you're shooting at them. But what's the realistic probability that you're going to be shooting at them? And that's one reason, right, of course, why somebody likes, why it's, we commonly see guided missile paired, is that suddenly you're in a position where you're punishing your opponent for not respecting your repeater network.
Right.
If they fail to clear a spotlight, or, you know, aren't basically playing the game back against you, you can punish them with guided missile shots, which, I mean, I'm not sure I like the overall health and design of that, but it certainly does make hacking supremely relevant, regardless of who your matchup is, and that's a big deal.
Yeah. And when you're moving into your opponent's repeater network, it is also very important to keep in mind what they have. Do they have a guided missile on the table? And so responding to that piece, especially, you know, think about the model you're sending forward. Is it one that you're okay losing, right? Is it okay that at the beginning of your opponent's next turn, they're going to spend one order and missile it? And I mean, I don't know what the actual probability is, but I would guess it's pretty close to 90% that one order is going to lead to the death of that model unless it's got three wounds. And you know, something that's got a marker state. You can enter a marker state even when you are targeted. So you can still, you know, there's still a risk. As soon as they discover you, then they can just throw that missile, but it's an order expenditure to get around a corner and get on top of a building and actually make the discover roll.
Yeah, and it's good that that counterplay exists, and it's good, too, that you have a multitude of options. And, you know, it justifiably, too, makes those midfield, you know, skirmisher camo guys powerful. It's also really nice, right, to be able to have your super jumping or climbing warband chain rifle mook who can run around and clear repeaters on your behalf.
Yeah.
You know, there's also opportunities for stealth to come into play. There's all sorts of applications that allow for interesting counterplay in the midfield. I think for me, one of the challenges of hacking is that it's annoying as hell to have to walk around to your opponent's side of the table all the time so you can see specifically where a repeater is located behind a high building. Mm-hmm. The number of times where you have to sort of continuously circle the table to remind yourself or be able to see where a repeater is so that you can identify that 8-inch zone and try and steer your troops around it. I'm not necessarily sure it's my favorite infinity dynamic, but there's no doubt that it's powerful. The ability to create, you know, exclusion zones or exclusion radiuses where your opponent, simply for activating a unit and walking around, can be punished. Yeah. It's significant, and I think it's really at the core of why people are running hacking and why hacking is powerful this edition.
Right, it can be a significant order drain. And then, of course, there are the opponents where, you know, they've got a Warband or a Harris that includes a few cheap models that are going to be able to put out some damage, and they, you know, they may run forward and say, cool, spotlight me all you want. I'm going to end my turn next to one of your models or in close combat and, you know, missile that. Right? So there are ways to get around it, but it is going to take some forethought and some potential sacrifice.
Yeah, and that's definitely smart play. I mean, there's definitely smart opportunity there. You know, it's functionally similar to hedging the bets on your tag by having your tag be in base contact with friendly troopers. You know, it helps to limit the impact of what could happen in the worst case scenario. And that's very much a good example of practices that you pick up in order to help mitigate or offset the danger that's there. I mean, thinking a little bit about the next topic here, which is hacking on the opponent's turn.
Right.
I mean, we've gone into that a little bit, but, yeah, I mean, being able to hack your opponent on their turn, I feel is obviously massive. It ties into the repeater network topic. You get your repeater network set up. Hopefully you pull your opponent's teeth, or you simply accept the risk that maybe he's going to have some act or turn hacking he can do. But hopefully you've layered or structured your hacking phase so that you're really choking off your opponent's ability to do anything in their turn. And with the range of core programs that we discussed, you know, Spotlight versus hackable targets, Oblivion is massive, of course. Significant stuff. You're forcing your opponent to make really difficult decisions, potentially game-ending or game-altering decisions, if he doesn't respect the fact that he's walking through your repeaters or maneuvering near your hackers.
Right. Because even a BTS-9 model with a firewall is still going to fail that Oblivion save on, what, an 8?
Yeah, like, I mean...
That's pretty good.
And I think that you bring up an interesting notion, too, and it's one that I think about a lot, is, you know, we're familiar with the hacking programs, we're familiar with their effects, but, you know, the inbuilt ammo type on them has such a huge impact on the probability of defense, the probability of save. Yes. Oblivion, the fact that it's got inbuilt AP, you know, the fact that it slices through BTS in that way is obviously significant, because suddenly the BTS-9 on your tag isn't such a big deal. Similarly too, a little bit more niche, but the fact that total control is double action as well, it gives it very high probability for tag possession, assuming you manage to sort of squeeze that through. Then, of course, the fact that both of those programs are available on the most common type of hacking device, so that are prevalent or spammable, is, you know, this is powerful stuff. I mean, the fact that you can have a WIP 12 line trooper be able to project that kind of game-ending, debilitating effect on a key opposing unit without presenting itself as a threat. I mean, that sort of commands respect as far as in-game impact.
Definitely. And I think that sort of is a nice bridge between these two, building your repeater network and hacking on your opponent's turn. You know, the ideal situation you're trying to create is that if your opponent wants to move forward with that tag to take out your, you know, flashbulb spot or linked arrow piece or whatever it is you're putting to slow them down, you want it to be that situation where the tag has to contend with both the opposing hack and the opposing shot. And even if that means, you know, your opponent sends a warband first to take out the repeater, they've spent an impetuous order, probably an irregular order, and then likely one or two other orders to get that warband into position to be able to clear out that repeater so that the tag can then make its move.
Yeah, and I think that that's something I think about a lot is the order mismatch that comes mm-hmm. from being able to deploy a repeater versus the lengths your opponent may have to go through to clear that repeater. Because right. here in conversation, we've established that, you know, letting your opponent have unopposed repeater control is incredibly strong. You know, if you're walking through their network and you have no solution for it, it can end disastrously for you.
Yeah.
And then I think the other consideration is how easily can that network be set up? You know, how many orders does it take them versus how many orders does it cost you to be able to clear that network? What are the risks? And, you know, you're exactly right. If you're selling the life of a piece and potentially putting three or four orders into removing the repeater, and even then, there's no guarantee. Obviously, we're getting into the nitty gritty, but, you know, can that warband get there? Is there a strong ARO protecting the repeater? Can that right. repeater see through smoke? You know, is there a solution? Is this a suicide run for the warband, or is he going to survive the attempt and successfully remove the repeater? What if he spends those orders and fails to remove the repeater? Maybe he's firing his chain rifle and the repeater passes its save. You know, these are all
yeah.
massive considerations in terms of, you know, the very simple premise of Infinity, which is spending your orders more efficiently than the other guy, doing things for fewer orders that make your opponent spend many orders, right. which allow you to, you know, surge ahead on points, create attrition, create the mismatch, etc. Right. And hacking is supreme at that. The ability to strongly impact your opponent and make them spend many orders using relatively few orders is a big deal.
Yeah. And then especially with terrain, I mean, ideally, every building has some kind of access point to get to the top. But let's say it's a building that doesn't have stairs or a ladder attached. There's a repeater on top and you don't have access to climbing plus. Right. That can present some real problems, absolutely shutting you out of a portion of the table. Conversely, even if there is a stairway up, maybe it's on the other side and you've got to spend orders getting around and putting down smoke so your opponent can't shoot you as you're getting up to it. And then while you're getting up to it, you're getting spotlit.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a classic nightmare scenario where your opponent, you know, is potentially deploying for free a repeater on a key objective or in a hotly contested right. area of the table. They've spent literally no orders in order to do that, depending on the army in question. And suddenly you're looking at expending a huge amount of orders to dislodge them. Massively significant in terms of impact, especially if it's a repeater that can sort of be placed down selectively or judiciously. You know, they can wait until the right time so that, you know, there's not the counterplay of, oh, at least I can hack through their repeater, or I can hack through their access their network and try and do some damage or attrition that way. So, yeah, these are all big considerations, but then they also feed back into sort of list building 101. You know, what should a list include? Oh, I should be able to climb up on a building and dislodge something. I should be able to fire up onto a building and hit models with speculative fire. You know, whatever the tool is, this is very much one of those hallmark meta considerations that you want to think about. You know, how do you get to something that's up on top of a building, whether it's a hacker, whether it's a model lurking until late game when it can have the greatest impact. All really important.
Definitely. All right. So shifting gears a little bit. When do you seek sixth sense? So you mentioned earlier those whip 12, you know, or whip 13, depending on your army, core linkable line infantry. If you are in a 4 or 5 member fire team, you put 6 sense on that model, which is great because it breaks stealth. On the other hand, if you are putting something in that fire team up to ARO, it presents you with some potential issues if you're trying to create those overlapped AROs where you have to make the choice of shoot, hack, or drop somebody out of the fire team. So. Yeah, what's your approach?
I'm a sectorial guy, and so I very much recognize the danger of having another method through which your opponent can incapacitate or break your link team. And so for me, I don't put hackers in a core team lightly because, as you mentioned, it does create one more method. However, you know, there are ways around that. You know, you evaluate the danger, you weigh the pros and cons. You have six linkable bodies instead of five, you know, one of whom is a hacker. So that right. you have the option on deployment of either having a five-man core team that does not include a hacker so that it's harder to break bonuses versus having a core team that does include a hacker for 6 cents. And that's just something that you can weigh and evaluate on deployment. But you know, you nailed as far as 6 cents being supremely powerful. You can have a hacker who has incredibly weak stats, but if he has 6 cents, can sort of break the ice and threaten stealth maneuvering models. It sort of opens the doorway up and helps to protect your other hackers, your lone hackers who may have superior stats or superior capabilities. Right. So, you know, you have to do the cost benefit analysis during deployment. But yes, frequently in hacking heavy armies, I will definitely have a hacker who's core linked because 6 cents is a pretty big deal.
Okay. Is that something you're considering if you have forward deployed repeaters, or are you avoiding it if you have forward deployed repeaters? Like, are you putting your hacking area in your deployment zone and then bam, definitely 6 cents because I need to break it at that point? Or are you putting that 6 cents hacker there with forward deployed repeaters, knowing that there is more risk to that, you know, 15.0 BTS whip 12 or 13 hacker?
Yeah, good question. And this links back to sort of the earlier growing pains, the lesson that I mentioned earlier about immediately getting my repeater network up and then sort of paying the price for it. I think if you'd asked me 18 months ago, I would have said, yeah, I'm putting all my hackers out there. I'm going to overwhelm my opponent with AROs. I'm going to make them roll against, you know, four different hacking AROs. So bring it on. And the guy who breaks stealth is part of it. The guy with six cents is part of it because he's sort of a crucial cog in that machine. But now I'd probably be more inclined to play a little conservative, you know, let attrition take grip in the game, try and remove a hacker or two. So for me, generally speaking, if I have upfield deployed hackers, I'm probably trying to minimize the risk as much as possible to models within my deployment zone. Yeah. So, you know, if I have upfield repeaters, the model in my DZ is probably going to be in danger regardless. I may try to make sure that he has six cents to give him the best possible likelihood of surviving incoming hacking threats. But then the flip side too is that I won't use that core team and I won't depend on its fire team bonuses for ARO. I recognize I'm giving my opponent an easy method for being able to deplete my team's core bonuses. So I'll deploy the team in a more conservative fashion, recognizing, hey, a guy has a very high likelihood of dying on turn one. I don't also want a guy to get shot. I don't want to give away two kills from my team. Let's try to limit it to one kill. Just so I'm not suffering overwhelming attrition on the first turn.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for those standout profiles that a number of armies have. And, you know, I keep going back and forth on this, right? So, for example, the Kamau in Varuna. It is a Whip 13 BTS 6 hacker. You know, obviously there's a little more cost because of the momentism and the BS 13. And so it's, what is it? 25 points, I think is the cost for that model. On paper, this is an excellent piece to use with the Peacemaker that shows up in Varuna, because now you've got a forward deployed repeater. You've got a BTS 6 hacker with, the firewall mods, and it is projecting threat. You put it in your core team with Fusiliers and or other Kamau. And now, you know, it's great. And then all of a sudden your opponent does Oblivion and, your hacker's isolated and lost the hacking device, or, Trinity gets through and you lose one roll and that hacker's gone. And the fragility of those one wound hackers, even with a high BTS, definitely makes those exchanges very swingy in a way that I feel like, you can often depend a little more on the shooting exchange because of the burst bonus, especially, that you can't with your hackers in defense.
Yeah. I think that's a very keen observation. And I think that it gets us into a really key consideration of hacking, which is sort of the number of dice you're dealing with, you know, relatively low numbers of dice. And as mentioned earlier, too, virtually every program is dealing with a specialty ammo of some type, which makes mm-hmm. them incredibly potent, very hard hitting. And so, as we know, armor as a stat in Infinity gets better the more wounds you have. You know, the more right. opportunity you have to fail a roll and keep applying armor as a defensive benefit. You know, a dude with armor 6 versus a tag with 3 wounds and multiple levels of unconscious in armor 6 are vastly different. We value them differently. We think about their application differently. A combi right. rifle is a massive threat to one, is a fairly minor threat to the other, and that all boils down to how armor and wounds are paired. Hackers and BTS are exactly the same thing. And so when I look at something like a Kamau, like, yeah, that BTS 6 is awesome, very, very cool. But as a one wound guy with fairly low whip and no ability to hide, you know, via marker state or anything else, it breaks down differently in terms of how vulnerable or how susceptible that model is. And so that's one reason why I think when we evaluate, we can evaluate hackers in a bubble, and then we can evaluate hacking in terms of an army's ability to mm-hmm. put a good hacker with decent stats on the table versus their ability to project threat through the sum of all their parts in hacking. Right. And so, like, Varuna is a really good example. I love the example that you mentioned there. Kamau at BTS-6 with decent whip by Pano standards. Peacemaker starting up the table. Okay, that seems like a great recipe for messing with your opponent turn one. You know, info war, great. But then at the same time, too, you have a guy who's standing in the open, is very, very susceptible to whatever program you're going to throw at him. You really need to layer multiple hackers in there for him to have backup, for him to have redundancy, to help deter your opponent from walking into a repeater and making those attempts. And then right. suddenly it's not just, oh, this is a nice addition to my list, I'll have one or two hackers. Suddenly you have to invest heavily right. for it to be both an active turn benefit or a strategic tactical deterrent. And I'm not sure a lot of armies are capable of doing that as well as other armies are.
Yeah. The point you make about wounds, I think, is a really important one to consider with hacking as well. Because, you know, let's say you've got a BTS-6 two wound heavy infantry hacker. When that heavy infantry is getting into a shootout, those wounds are going to be very important. When that heavy infantry is getting hit by Trinity, those wounds are going to be very important. When it gets hit by Oblivion, those wounds don't mean anything, because all you need to do is fail one save and then it is isolated and unable to use that hacking device anymore.
Yeah, and that's a very important distinction. And I think the fact that Oblivion basically allows for that one-shot mechanic is one of the reasons why it's so powerful, you know, sort of meta-defining as a program, especially considering how widely available it is on different hacking devices. I mean, I think one thing that's nice about heavy infantry hackers, an advantage they retain is, yes, as you mentioned, they have all of that aforementioned durability. And then in a lot of ways, too, you can offset Oblivion by having an engineer nearby right. to help repair. And, you know, that can be a problem, bad rolls, it can turn into a sink. It all depends on the circumstance. You know, maybe a team gets broken, has to be reformed. You know, there are a lot of hypotheticals, but right. at least in terms of how armies are structured, embedded engineers are popular, they're pervasive, they're easy to do. And I think that that helps provide some counterplay, but with the caveat that it's still an order sink. You know, if you're oblivioning a guy and making him spend orders in his own turn to recuperate, you know, to clear the isolated state or whatever, it's still a net gain, and a
right.
pretty considerable net gain.
Right. Especially because that model's order has become irregular. So they've lost access to that order as, you know, part of the order pool, and they've spent the order to heal that guy out of isolated. and they potentially spent a command token to reform that fire team, that is a pretty good drain if you're able to get that Oblivion off.
And that has me thinking a little bit about a topic further down the list here. You know, what makes a strong hacker? And, you know, I'll preface by saying I feel like the individual stats of individual hackers are a lot less significant than sort of the sum of all parts, you know, repeater coverage, pitchers, overall cost, et cetera. But, you know, what does that mean to you, Kyle? You know, what makes for a strong hacker?
I don't really know yet. So there's a couple things that come to mind. So a model that stands out in my mind is obviously the Anathematic, right? It is wildly expensive. But the fact that it has a marker state, hidden deployment is nice. It's got high BTS, and it not only has access to those regular programs so it can target hackable models, but it also has access to Trinity. And, you know, obviously it's got Burst 4, which is great. But in the reactive turn, it means that you can be in that situation where an opponent may be able to leverage their hacker against you. They may be able to get that firewall mod, but you are able to react with that +3 bonus, which is really significant, especially on a high whip model. So I think having access to a marker state is a vital tool, especially for an expensive hacker. And then having some way to apply bonuses is also really good, whether that's Trinity or one of those rare models that, you know, has a built-in bonus or penalty on the opponent to their program, right? The oh gosh, I'm forgetting their name. The assassin hacker that has a Trinity with the -3 bonus on their opponent.
Oh yeah, is that the Bereed?
Yeah. So having some way to sort of stack those bonuses, and then obviously being surrounded by a Tinbot -6 is also a way to push what would be a good hacker to being a great hacker, right? If you are in a link team where anyone trying to hack you is just taking a -6 penalty, even if Oblivion getting through means that you're isolated and that's gone, that -6 can mean it just becomes an order sink, because if they're hitting you on 7s or 8s with 2 dice, that's a bad exchange.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All good observations. And I was, I mean, I laughed to myself a little bit when you mentioned the Anathematic, because I was actually going to lead with my example as the Asura, you know, very much the active counterpart, you know, for a lot of the same reasons that you mentioned. And it's funny because I don't actually consider most sort of point supercharged high stat hackers to really be what defines good hacking. But I do like the fact that the Anathematic and then the Asura as well can really sort of take it to the next level. I think the fact that they have, you know, the full range of programs, access to marker state, you know, the Asura on the Hacking Device Plus also has a Trinity and an upgraded Trinity at that. So not only is there high probability on individual exchanges because of high whip, good BTS, the superiority of the programs, a broad range of programs, allowing for toolbox, possibility of using marker state to insulate yourself or stack the odds in your favor. But, you know, you're also dealing with an army that has a ton of support for that unit, you know, reliable engineers, things of that nature. So definitely the examples of good hackers there with these sort of powerhouse 60 plus point units, but that's not the type of hacking that most armies are doing.
Right.
And for me, the best hacker is the one that has, you know, burst 2 pitchers that it can utilize. and that's basically all there is to it. I mean, the stats for me, the programs for me, et cetera, are almost irrelevant. You know, as long as they have a standard device, which pretty much everybody has access to, and the ability to, you know, fire pitchers with burst two for, you know, high probability of getting one where you want it. You can be reasonably assured of good order efficiency. You can reach into the opponent's deployment zone on turn one if you want to. That's what defines a good hacker for me, is the one who can utilize that as a tool. You can have all line trooper hackers at whip 12, whip 13, but if they have the ability to quickly turn the game on a dime by getting those pitchers where they want with maximum mortar efficiency, they're going to have a strong hacking phase, or they have the ability to apply a strong hacking phase.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've touched on this idea a little bit, right, with the single failed save, with the special ammo types. Realistically, if you are able to get the firewall mods in your favor, I mean, even the anathematic, you don't want to be in a reactive turn exchange against a line trooper, because all it takes is one failed save and then your 70-80 point model is isolated, or, you know, stuck in a place where your opponent can really take advantage, get into close combat, make some, you know, unopposed rolls against it. And that's what you don't want to happen.
And it's funny too, that even in hacking, one of the core tenets of Infinity holds true, which is that virtually every model is dangerous to every other model in some way. You know, the probability of inflicting a wound is nowhere near zero, and frequently it's far, far above that. You know, virtually everything has the ability to be very, very dangerous to other models under the right circumstances. And that's true with, you know, the lowliest hacker versus the most powerful hacker. Should it be that way? I don't know, but there's, you know, absolutely no doubt that powerhouse hackers have to respect every hacking opponent on the table, because there's real danger there.
Right. Right. And, you know, all of that said, the hackers that I put on the table the most are not the Asura or the Anathematic, right? The hackers that I'm going to be using the most, it's going to be the line trooper that I might put in a link and the skirmisher that is sub 30 points.
How many hackers do you find yourself including in your lists? And, you know, I guess I'll preface that by saying, you know, hacking focus lists, as well as, you know, standard lists where you feel as though hacking is not the dominant theme. How many are you aiming for, and what types of devices?
Yeah. So very common across all armies is I will try to include a skirmisher killer hacker and a skirmisher hacker. And that's not, I'm not going to do that every time, but that's a pretty common baseline for me, because on the one hand, both of them are specialists. The hacker is going to be a very useful tool if my opponent brought a tag, is leaning on an aggressive heavy infantry, or has that moment where they're moving a piece up towards an objective, and I can, you know, reveal that hacker from a marker state or hidden deployment and get that reactive arrow to cost them extra orders, slow them down, right? That as a utility is absolutely potent. And then the killer hacker is going to be there because often, you know, I think it's very easy to create in your mind's eye the situation where the Nomad player has all of the repeaters up and anything you do is going to be reacted to by all of their hackers. But it's pretty common that your midfield skirmishing killer hacker is going to have an opportunity on turn two or turn three to scalpel out a very particular hacking target that is causing you problems. And having that at your disposal is very useful, especially when that is like when I'm playing Yu Qing, say, a ninja hacker that also has close combat efficacy, or, you know, a Zulu Cobra killer hacker that is a very good gunfighter with AP breaker ammo. Having that additional piece of being able to scalpel out the hacker on top of being a specialist, on top of being a relatively effective combat piece, means that I'm almost always going to bring that killer hacker. How about you?
I can definitely echo that sentiment with the killer hacker. Definitely. You know, it's easy to deal in hyperbole when we talk about the danger of an opponent creating an impregnable defense, you know, full of repeaters with perfect coverage and multiple hackers. Right. They are able to air out everything. But as you rightly observe, that's rarely what ends up happening. You know, even talented players will often leave some kind of gap or some kind of oversight. And especially when you have models that are deploying as markers, you know, even the most canny opponent may still be left guessing by what's underneath a marker. And so the ability to say, hey, I've got this killer hacker. Hey, I'm going to go burst three against your burst one, get that kill, is great. You know, that's bread and butter infinity tactics. And, you know, I like it too for the scoring potential. Killer hackers are cheap. They don't cost any SWC. And the ability to score easy objectives off of them is considerable, right? So I virtually always include one in situations where I have the opportunity to do so. For me, I agree that's a no-brainer. And then most of the killer hacker profiles, they usually bring another utility too. You mentioned the breaker rifle on the Zulu Cobra, which is obviously a big deal when you're a BS-13 mimetic gunfighter. You know, even mines on a basics camo skirmisher, a Naga, or something like that, you're always going to be able to find ways to get mileage out of that. And it's nice too that you rarely feel as though you're overpaying for a killer hacking device just because it is so cheap. The and standard hacking device,
before you move on, especially this season with the objective piece where so many missions have the hacker bonus, so that killer hacker is going to be benefiting and rolling two dice on a 16 or a 17, which is a great way to consistently grab those objectives.
That is a big deal. And I was thinking about the other, you know, sort of the pairing that you identified where you have a killer hacker as well as a regular hacking device, both on camo infiltrators. I think the regular hacking device is a bold choice, is a brave choice. You know, I know for me, I very much like redundancy in a lot of my decisions. Like I'm super distrustful, especially as a sectorial player, of like a one dice ARO. I almost always want, you know, multiple AROs, two dice AROs, whether it's multiple hackers doubling up on a single target. And so I can appreciate the ability to leverage a single regular device in one place. I guess for me, from my perspective, list building, it never feels like enough. I always feel like it needs backup, that I need to, be able to lob a pitcher and have a linked guy in the deployment zone who can lend another Oblivion ARO in tandem with it. But at the same time too, you're creating a really nice level of uncertainty with that regular device where your opponent doesn't know what's under that marker until you're applying it, leveraging it, it reveals, and he gets to see what it is. And so I think that's a really nice way to be able to keep your opponent off balance. Cause you can Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's definitely rare that I'm using that hacker as an ARO, but it does come up. And part of this also is the current place I am at where I am reacting to pieces being taken off the table when they're not in a marker state by a missile or a bear very effectively. And so adding that extra layer of, you know, I'm bringing these two skirmishers along with, you know, say a mine layer or a couple of overlapping AROs that are going to cover them, so they're not hanging out in the wind, or like best case scenario, they're both in hidden deployment, right? I've been playing Vanilla Yuching a lot, and so bringing two ninjas, one hacker, one killer hacker has been something I've been leaning into. Alternatively, with a hacker, the Tiger Soldier, something that's AD, that's off the table, so it can't be targeted in an unfavorable situation until you've brought it on the table, is a great way to be able to put that hacker exactly where you need it at the moment you need it, although obviously you're not going to be doing that in your reactive turn.
Well, kind of brings us to another topic that is a valuable one, and, you know, the topic is, you know, when to use marker states, how to use marker states. But I think we can also include airborne deployment in that conversation as well, because it is another way of effectively masking a unit, making it invulnerable or at least not in play until, you know, you choose to initiate it. you know, what units do you look for and how do you like to use marker state packers? You know, what stands out for you as sort of a universal practice that you like to apply?
So part of this might be the fact that I've been playing Joe, aka Puma Driftcat, who I think skews my play experience quite a bit, because he's a player who approaches the game in almost like independently of the way that you would expect a meta to approach a game. He'll show up with a list and I'll look at it and think like, oh, okay, I know exactly what this camo marker is. And then it just won't be that because he brought a model that I've never seen anyone else bring.
That's like a Poly Nike special right there. Going against the grain with the meta can yield amazing results. Right. Don't let anybody tell you differently, folks. Go ahead. Continue.
So in that context, one of the things that I found playing against him a lot is that using models on the table in my recent experience just tends to be a liability. So as much as possible, obfuscating, putting things under a camo marker, or putting things off the table or in a hidden deployment state, and then layering defenses with cheap stuff. And so this is like almost the exact opposite of how I had been playing with Steel Phalanx, which has been really refreshing, right? Really turning things on its head and playing very differently. So with my Vanilla Yuching, I've been layering Quangxi, Monks, and Longya as my kind of core defense. I've got templates, and then I've got these two camo markers that have long range. My opponent knows exactly what they are, but I'm overlapping AROs so that they're not looking across the table, so they've got to move forward to discover or just risk running past and having to contend with a Panzerfaust or a Flamenspear. And in the context of that, everything is in a marker state as long as it possibly can be, or hidden as long as it possibly can be. I am always ending my turn where my hackers, if they can be, are back in a marker state, because I never want to be in that situation where, you know, I've left my ninja hacker up and here's a model where I'm paying for good close combat. I'm paying for mimetism -6 and my opponent just runs a killer hacker up and kills it. And so I don't want that situation. So using those marker states to insulate and protect, not just on the hacker, but on the models around it, I think is absolutely vital.
I feel like that fits well with one of, you know, Infinity's sort of great general isms, which is, you know, if you can't be, you know, the safest model is the one that can't be targeted, you know, and if you're prone in a marker state on a rooftop, that's really about as safe as you can be. Even better than that, of course, is being off the table, you know, whether it's hidden deployment, whether it's you know, airborne deployment, et cetera. We're talking about, you know, supreme tactical advantage. And then that ties further into the ism that the longer you keep something out of play, the more powerful it can be when it shows up, especially with, you know, a three turn structure, the way that scoring works. You know, if you can keep that hacker secret so that your opponent commits himself to other things, the game unfolds, you know, you get those flashpoints or hotspots on the table where you're both trying to sort of bring the appropriate tools to bear, spending the appropriate amount of orders. If you can suddenly throw a hacker into the mix who's been lurking in marker state the entire time, that's massive. If your opponent didn't know that that was there as a tool or there as a resource, and you managed to keep it hidden for a long time. And, you know, I always have tremendous appreciation too. I hate it, but I also appreciate it when players keep like a 30 plus point hidden deployment unit deployed next to an objective for the entire game. And then turn three, they reveal it and walk over and boop the button and score massively. You know, the control, the willpower that it takes to not deploy that unit for earlier, juicier opportunities. So hackers play into that too, where the longer you can keep them hidden, it doesn't necessarily depreciate or deplete from their value. sometimes the longer you hold a resource in reserve, the bigger the impact it has when it does arrive and make a difference. And sometimes that impact can be turn three when the game is on the line and you bring an entirely new dynamic to the conflict that your opponent wasn't prepared for.
Right. I mean, if your opponent has been running around with a tag for two turns and feels like you haven't responded with a hacker and so makes a careless move or is trying to secure an objective or protect an objective at the end of the game, and suddenly you've got an angle to get in behind it in zone of control with a hacker, that's massive. And your opponent may not leave that opportunity in turns one or two because they are being more careful. They're being more cautious. They haven't lost pieces yet. They don't have gaps in their defense yet. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, frequently the hardest opportunity to bring a unit into play is, as you mentioned, right at the start when your opponent is put, you know, you may have spent 20 minutes preparing a very careful deployment that has no chinks, has no cracks. And that tends to be the area where your opponent's defense is going to be the strongest because everything's on the table. He's most prepared. And he's had a phase dedicated entirely to making sure it's the best it's going to be. So, well, I feel like we've been sort of tiptoeing around the elephant in the room. I'd be happy to chat about it now if you're up for it.
Yeah,
Spotlight
go for it.
And missiles.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your, you've been playing Bakunin. How do you approach it? How do you use it? So not playing against it yet, but just using it.
I hate it. I wish it wasn't part of the game. I mean, and you know, I don't stand on principle when it comes to making use of tools. You know, people use it. I have used it. I recognize it's part of the game. I'm not averse to meta considerations. If something is good, I'll put it on the table. I just find that, you know, past editions have made such a hullabaloo about mechanics that felt non-interactive or mechanics that felt powerful, especially defensively when you are actively shutting down your opponent's turn and creating dynamics that pin them and led to an unfun experience. I feel like the game made such a point of getting away from that only to double down on it this edition with Spotlight, with guided missiles, with hacking in general. And so it's rough. I mean, I think the only thing you can really do is play the repeater game, you know, be aware of those repeaters, make those many trips around the table to see exactly where your opponent's repeaters are and play there, or put together a strategy for just being able to remove their guided missile bot from the table. Some armies are going to be better at it than others. You know, for some armies, being able to remove a key piece in an opponent's deployment zone is a trivial consideration. For other armies, it's much more difficult.
Right. If you've got access to Algebel and two fidés, right, you can make it happen.
Yeah. And that's easy. Or, you know, if you have guided yourself, there's absolutely no reason why you can't, you know, lob that pitcher, you know, Spotlight and just nuke that thing until it's gone. And you know, these are all valid. I've seen them in games. I've used them. I've had them used against me. But for me, having somebody lob pitchers at the top of turn one and having everything hinge on the outcome of those one or two dice exchanges, you know, does the pitcher land efficiently? Yes or no? Does the spotlight go off easily? Active turn? Yes or no? You know, you applying guided and spotlight in the active turn and the reactive turn are slightly different experiences, but I think both are valid, effective, frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what do you do against it? How do you oppose it? You know, your opponent sets up, you see the missile bot, you see some forward deployed repeaters, you see that camo marker that's probably a heckler that's gonna jump forward and throw out a fast panda and put a repeater exactly where it needs to be. What's your plan?
You know, spacing is obviously a big deal. You know, using your reserve drop to actually try to put, you know, your most important piece as far away from the, you know, the possibility of the repeater as you can possibly arrange.
Yeah.
You know, potentially too, there's also some opportunity for ambush and things like that. You know, it's, wherever that repeater ends up, you know, maybe you have a hacker there who can at least create some roles, you know, that your opponent has to consider. Another possibility too, and this is rare, but sometimes it happens. You know, you can use a hidden deployment arrow to great effect, you know, sometimes to literally snipe the guy who's standing out to fire those pitchers. And that does happen. You know, you do have to reveal yourself to a degree in order to get a pitcher down the table. And so if your opponent telegraphs the lane they're going to use, sometimes you can interdict that. It doesn't always have to be hidden deployment too. You know, if your opponent really telegraphs the lane they're going to use, sometimes you can literally just stand your biggest, baddest ARO piece on a rooftop and be like, okay, peek around that corner. Let's see how this goes down. And then you can create enough of an order drain where your opponent has to work around that situation, maneuver around that situation, or challenge your gunfighter with a different piece. Sometimes you can get traction there and it'll serve as a deterrent, make your opponent follow a different tack on turn one. But, you know, it's hard because all of that is circumstantial and a lot of it relies too on your opponent, you know, making a mistake, or you spotting the threat in time, both of which are a lot of pressure to put on a player, you know, really before the game even begins.
Right. And then, you know, there's also trying to go first to take out the threatening pieces. And depending on your army, that can be a very substantial challenge, right? If your pieces all have to march across the table. So AD becomes very useful, especially if you've got something like Van Zant or Razziat that can come in on the back edge of the deployment zone and kill that missile bot. If you have something like a Fide or a Speculo killer, being able to move 16 inches without having any risk to the model, right? Because you do a double move and your opponent discovers and removes the first layer, and you do a double move, your opponent discovers and removes the second layer, and then you still have that third move to get into attack position. Obviously, if you're revealed and in line of sight at the end of that second order, then that's sort of a problem and you're taking a huge risk. But when you can deploy right up against the deployment zone, 16 inches of unopposed movement is probably going to be able to get to the missile bot unless they've done some very solid body blocking with stairwells and ladder access type of thing.
Yeah, and that's a great approach too. And I think that's also one reason why the whole dynamic of guided missile leaves me feeling a little flat is because different armies are able to react to it in different ways. Some have a great tool chest for being able to remove that one key threat. Others don't. And it's the same thing, you know, with going first. Like, yeah, go first. Give yourself a jump on, you know, relieving pressure on the problem. You know, create problems, hotspots, and other areas of the table that an opponent is going to want to dump orders into, you know, force them into a situation where they have to commit towards following their guided missile plan versus something else. But, you know, some armies are better at getting first turn than others. And even the highest whip lieutenant can fail the role or lose the role and, you know, are at the mercy of whatever the other guy wants. So, it's tough. It's tricky.
Yeah, the other thing that I found to be very effective is to just present no targets. And this becomes difficult because with the move over to N4, a lot of those skirmisher lieutenant profiles disappeared. And that was, you know, I found that very sad for things like decapitation. I remember the Dasu lieutenant, even though it was 2 SWC. Was really nice to have an Aelif or OSS. But now, again, I mentioned earlier, I'm playing Vanilla Yuching. The Dao Ying lieutenant, as far as I'm concerned, is probably the best lieutenant in the game. Adding two orders with a bunch of really good NCO profiles and being in a marker state back in your deployment zone where your opponent is very unlikely to be able to discover it. And therefore, it will be impossible to, you know, spotlight in order to get that missile on, is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, that's Rockstar support capacity, you know, and I'm very much a fan of, you know, the anonymous line trooper lieutenant. But I know too that the 15 order cap this edition actually makes it much more difficult to include, you know, multiple clones. You know, back right. in the day when you could have three or four lieutenant clones without pushing yourself too hard, the thought of, you know, a guided missile assassination was just a game of probability. You know, is my opponent going to pick out the right one? More power to him. Versus now, where, you know, I'm lucky sometimes if I have a second blank line trooper to double as a lieutenant. And that becomes a consideration too. You know, do I make my list weaker in other areas in order to make my opponent have to guess, have to choose, even if it means not having a crucial paramedic where I need it, even if it means not having, you know, another useful utility-based profile.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not sure that there are necessarily right and wrongs here, but there's certainly good practices. And, you know, we certainly we hear stories all the time about players doing well with guided missiles, about players defeating guided missiles. So I don't think it's a, I don't know, is it a problem? Sometimes I think it's a problem. Sometimes I think it's okay. I feel like it varies depending on my mood, whether or not I hate this or I just live with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for the negative play experience, because if your opponent is able to get that pitcher down in a place that you thought was safe, and then your army unravels because you are unable to respond to it, that's a pretty negative experience. And the fact that a reset does not oppose that missile launch, I think is, I mean, in my mind, that would be an easy fix, because, you know, the missile is still hitting on 18, right? It's not like it's a great chance that you would beat it with a reset at -3. But having the option to dodge, where even if you successfully dodge and avoid that missile, you're still spotlit. Another missile's probably coming. Now you've cost your opponent two orders. Like, that's not much more than a consolation prize.
Right.
Whereas if you could actually oppose the missile and get yourself out of the situation, you know, then it still is an utterly useful tool to have, because if you manage to spotlight your opponent and then you just, oh yeah, I'll just spend an order in my second pool and throw a missile at it, see if it dies, right? That's still incredibly powerful. But it also means that the other player would not feel totally out of options when that missile, or when that pitcher lands, when that missile is being shot.
Yeah, I think that's a good consideration. And, you know, I guess ultimately it's up to CB whether right. they, you know, the game is designed around forcing those difficult decisions, you know, right. the reset right. versus the shoot. You know, the dodging the chain rifle versus rolling your ballistic skill based attack and eating that damage 13 hit. You know, this is a, sort of a key consideration of how Infinity creates interchange between players. But, you know, how much is too far? And I think you pose a good question of, you know, does being repeatedly bombarded with missiles with no way to clear the state, Is that a positive experience? You know, certainly it's the reality. So we play with it, we play around it, but are we happy with it?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fair question. All right. Before this becomes the Spotlight and Missiles podcast, what about using things like firewalls, tin bots, and fairy dust to mitigate hacking? How, you know, depending on your army, depending on what you've got access to, how often are you reaching for those? Are you going out of your way to get them? Are you using that Evo bot to put fairy dust on your heavy infantry link? What's your situation?
So that'd be a hilarious name for a troll episode, by the way. But yes.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, it's tin bots, obviously undeniably strong, incredibly strong. And I very much feel too that, you know, just like there's a significant haves and have nots when it comes to the ability to deploy pitchers, you know, repeaters, get them downfield. There's very much a haves and have-nots when it comes to TinBot, but I don't mind this one as much simply because, you know, it's innately defensive. There are definitely restrictions on who all can benefit from the TinBot. you know, it definitely forces you into a certain list building dynamic to be able to invest in the tin bot and get it in a list. It is frustrating because, you know, basically there are some armies where you would like to be able to hack them, and then they just become unhackable with Tinbot minus six, and so be it. But yeah, Tinbots are incredibly strong and don't seem to cost that much. So yeah, if you have access to one, why not take it? Why not use it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is Tinbots in particular. And in my mind, there's sort of this glaring gap, which, you know, I know is personal preference and experience, but OSS as an army that is entirely remotes and hackable models, not packing a tin bot to be able to put into those links to protect those remotes is such a wild gap in their defense, which, you know, I'm sure there's sort of some feeling of, oh, well, if you've got a Dava hacker or oh gosh, I'm forgetting all kinds of names of models. Donovas hacker in a link with a tin bot, would that be problematic? Well, I don't know. Considering some of the things that can go in fire teams with tin bot minus six, I don't think it'd be that problematic, but who knows? Maybe it would be.
Yeah, it's and you raise a valid point about how interesting it is that some armies have gotten and some armies have not. You know, obviously, Invincible Army, okay, you see the obvious logic there. If they were susceptible to every hacking heavy opponent and matchup, you know, the army would be dead in the water. But at the same time, here you have Aelith, who can make a similar argument. You know, this is their fundamental link, their line trooper link. Where's the defense?
Right.
I'd be curious to know the logic there. But I guess, you know, it's, we find ways to play around it, and it seems like Aelith certainly has, you know, good hackers, the ability to exert good hacking in other ways. But it is interesting because the allotting of tin bots almost feels arbitrary sometimes. And it seems like tin bot minus six is always reserved for certain factions. It's a big piece of equipment. And there are lots of factions that have tin bots, but relatively few that have tin bot minus six.
Yeah. And, you know, you can definitely see some places where CB have very carefully kind of etched out this gap where, you know, nomads have a lot of tin bot minus sixes, but you are never going to get that tin bot into a fire team with a Grenzer. Or not a Grenzer, oh my god, my unit names today. What is going on? An Interventor, right? That
sure.
Whip 15 BTS-9 hacker, is, you know, you're not sticking that in a fire team with a 10-bot minus 6.
Yeah. You know, for which I think we can probably all be grateful, but at the same time, too, that's probably the... That would probably be the only profile that's actually truly safe from Oblivion outside of... hackers that simply outright ignore the isolated state to begin with.
I guess that's a consideration worth putting in. We talked about what makes a strong hacker. There are a handful of veteran hackers out there, and Oblivion being what it is, that double action damage 16, being immune to isolated is a pretty significant factor in a hacker's survivability.
I mean, it is funny to watch people like look back at, you know, their app to be like, oh crap, what do I use now? I mean, Oblivion being so prevalent, being like, okay, I guess I'll carbonite you. You know, they say it with such a sort of a monotone, disheartened expression in their voice. It's a big deal to be able to rob somebody of the effects of their best program. No doubt about that whatsoever. So that's definitely a consideration. You can have a hacker whose stats almost don't matter. If they ignore Oblivion, you're going to have a really powerful tool.
Right. Yeah, that Morat, the new Morat hacker. I mean, it's not new now. It's, 8 months old, but still. I think I said double action AP on Oblivion. Definitely my mistake.
Yeah, specialty ammo type that makes BTS a lot less relevant than it would be otherwise. Right. I knew what you were about there.
So what about Fairy Dust? How often are you using fairy dust on that Evo hacker?
You know, I think the best thing about fairy dust is the fact that you can give it to units, entire unit categories that typically can't benefit from, or typically are not benefiting from things like Tinbot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're romping around with your combat rem or, you know, your big boy tag, yeah, there are circumstances where that benefit has tremendous impact, tremendous potential.
Yeah.
You know, it's still an order invested. Sometimes you spend it, sometimes you don't, depending on the perceived danger on the table. But if you've taken the time to invest in Evo, it's certainly just as good a consideration and a tool to have in your toolbox as anything else you'd spend an order on. And sometimes, yeah, it can have a very, very real impact.
Yeah. My sort of gold standard of where and when to use it, playing OSS, where you're likely bringing an Evo bot to buff your Dakini Link anyway. And then if you've got the Asura hacker, because she's a heavy infantry, you can apply fairy dust to her. And now she is a premier hacker with good stats. She's got that Trinity with the bonus damage, and now she effectively always has cover in hacking exchanges. You know, there are very few moments where it is that advantageous, and obviously now you're doing fairy dust and it's only affecting one model, as opposed to that, you know, invincible army situation where, I mean, they've already got tin bots, so you're not spending the order on fairy dust, but something like that where you've got a heavy infantry link that doesn't have a tin bot very often, and you can just apply that bonus to them to insulate them a little bit.
Yeah. It is an interesting consideration. I guess I'm trying to think about the last time I actually used fairy dust.
Right.
And I guess just in the way that I structure my lists, I usually try to have two combat groups, both of which are capable of maneuvering and playing aggressively. You know, mm-hmm. maybe not necessarily shooting at stuff, but headed in the direction of objectives. And I guess sort of spending that order in what feels like kind of a passive situation that's dependent on me misplaying.
Yeah.
I guess I don't use it as much as I might have actively preached a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it sure is nice if you've identified the mismatch or you realize that hacking is incoming and you want just a little bit of extra protection. I know I try to actively keep track of the number of times it's made a difference. The number feels very, very small, but obviously that's my own experience and my own bias. It doesn't necessarily change the fact that modifiers are modifiers, you know,
right.
Use them and, to effect.
You know, I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that there are so many tin bots that vanilla armies are getting duos and sectorials are leaning on fire teams where those tin bots are going to apply across that fire team. And so the fairy dust is not going to add anything to that, right? Because they are both firewall bonuses. So you're not, I mean, you're not going to double up on it, right? You're not going to spend the extra orders on it. It's got to be that situation where you've got a heavy infantry link. It doesn't have access to a tin bot, or you are in matched up against a hacking heavy army and you've got a tag and you really, you know, you already have the Evo bot. Cause I doubt you're bringing the Evo bot for just that one program, right? You're probably bringing it for marksmanship on your remotes, most likely.
Agreed. And you know, it's a situation where I do actually like fairy dust is, you know, not every army has the ability to just teleport a pitcher or a repeater into range of an enemy hacker with no danger. You know, oftentimes many armies have to physically walk a repeater into range. And, you know, I'll do that a lot, especially if I'm playing Pano, you know, where pitchers just aren't really a thing. If I'm in a position where I want to actually kill or hack an opponent's hacker, usually that means that I have to physically walk the hacker there, or I have to run like a Fugazi, you know, a flash pulse bot into range. And that is a situation where fairy dust is a big deal because you need to be able to run the remote into that hacking zone of control and then do a reset or something so that the remote, the repeater, is active there in the zone of control so that you can follow up, and being able to survive that one turn of deliberate danger so that you can thereby have the repeater in place and exert follow-up hacking control over your opponent. That's definitely sort of a set piece situation where getting a little bit of extra survivability makes a big difference.
Yeah. Okay. So I think really the last topic I want to touch on here, I wrote when to hack versus when to shoot. And, you know, I think obviously there's sort of a cheeky way we can look at this, but really what I'm going for is your order expenditure, right? When are you thinking about, I'm going to spend the order on the pitcher that might have to end up being an extra order to use baggage and then another order to put that pitcher down again, right? And then I've got to spend another order to spotlight. So that's 2 to 4 orders. And then your next order to missile, or maybe you're doing 2 to 4 orders to get the pitcher down and oblivion attack. When are you doing that versus just applying gun to face?
I think there's, you know, probably two answers to that. The first is, you know, well, in both cases, the answer is really when it's more order efficient.
Right.
You know, if you're reaching into your opponent's deployment zone to drop a guided missile on a model that's in total cover, that could very easily be far more than 10 orders. If you try to walk a good gunfighter across the table, have him slog through half your opponent's army, fighting his way through the deployment zone, climbing up on a building and physically shooting that guy, that may not be possible. Right. And so there's obviously a threat vector there where the attack is more order efficient via hacking. But, you know, you raised the good point, too, that hacking is not always the most order efficient route. You know, if you see a guy and you can shoot him with your combi rifle versus you see a guy and you can throw one dice at oblivion, ultimately, it depends, you know, how durable the model in question is. But, you know, dice are king, burst is king. You very rarely want to try to use a one dice exchange versus your opponent's one dice defense when you can bring overwhelming firepower to bear instead. But, you know, the advantage of hacking is you can project it unexpectedly. It works through walls. You don't need line of sight. So you have to sort of balance the two. When is it more order efficient? When is it less order efficient?
Yeah. And I think there's also, you know, the considerations of what are the units that are doing the attacking, right? If the shooting exchange, maybe you're spending more orders to get the shooting exchange, but you're doing it on a Harris, and that Harris has a specialist. So you're moving the specialist into position as you are moving your gunfighter into position. So, you know, and of course, maybe that pitcher is in a fire team. So you're advancing with the model that has the pitcher, you're shooting the pitcher, and then you're switching to the gunfighter, and then you're switching to the specialist, right? These are all kind of considerations to take into mind that sometimes you may want to be spending orders on one thing in order to move other models forward, right? You've got a Duo or a Harris, whatever it is, or you've got a model that has a couple different applications. I think those are all worth considering.
Yeah, I think that's a really good consideration. Sometimes you can take, you know, low probability exchanges, or you can take the risk on having interactions of those kinds, as long as the team is all sort of moving in a coherent direction. You know, if the goal really is to sprint to an objective in the midfield, and you have, you know, leftover, you know, short skills to be able to utilize, you know, sometimes you can throw out a low probability hacking attempt, or sometimes you can try a fluff spotlight on somebody, even though it's not something you probably want to spend orders on in your active turn anyway. You know, Harris teams, core teams, duos create that dynamic where you're still retaining order efficiency by moving guys towards objectives or maneuvering for fire lanes, but then you can use that short skill for activities that may not have warranted their own specific order, but you'll gladly do in the context of broader maneuvers.
Yeah. Great. Okay. So I think that's really what we wanted to cover today, just talking about using hacking and some considerations and some things you want to do. I'm sure there's somebody listening right now who's yelling at their radio that, like, guys, why didn't you talk about? So I apologize for that. Thanks for listening anyway.
Make sure to send angry messages to Kyle so that way in a follow-up episode we can address with those particular concerns.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or don't.
Right, you know, I mean, Discord is an easy place. On the IGL Discord channel, you'll find the WIP12. On the IGL Discord server, on the WIP12 channel, the episode posts. And if you ping Kyle B there, then you'll find me and I'll respond to you at some point. I apologize that I'm not that consistent on Discord. I won't necessarily reply that day, but probably pretty soon after. Any last considerations you want to throw out there before we sign off?
Well, this has been a fun one to sort of wrap my mind around, just because having seen all the permutations and sort of the evolution of hacking and the form that it's in now, it's interesting to see how far it's come. And at the same time, too, try to make my peace with it, because I've had mixed feelings about it. Sometimes I've ignored it as a phase in previous editions. And now, as a player who's leaning into it, it's been interesting to sort of do this summary and do this retrospective. Because yeah. I'm not an expert by any means. You know, I'm a relative newcomer to it. And so being able to sort of do the deep dive has been helpful, valuable, and it gives me additional insight as a player.
Great. All right. Well, I appreciate having you on. Hopefully our listeners do too, and appreciate hearing me and you, you know, just wax philosophical.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Yeah. Well, we'll catch you next time. And listeners, thanks for listening. Roll some dice, and may the dice be with you. And we'll call that a wrap.